Welcome to another episode of Mick and the Fat Man, where we are talking artists, albums, and everything music. Well, welcome everybody to another exciting episode of Mick and the Fat Man. Did you notice, Mick, that I only just sort of noticed it then, the new intro that I've done, I've been able to use the word everything.
I like that. I thought, yeah, you bring it down to the common man.
Everything. Music.
Yeah.
I'm class. I'm all class. Welcome to series 4, episode number 3, everybody. G'day, Mick. Happy rock and roll to you, sir, and how are you travelling?
Well, I'm travelling well, mate, and I must say after this is now the third episode of season four. Four years of this stuff. I've had complaints from people about how their ears are bleeding from our new intro.
Gets you, doesn't it?
Yeah. I can't see any blood on your shirt. I mean, it's most unfair.
It's not doing me much good, I can tell you. Pretty in there. Yeah. I feel like it's like a stadium rock intro. I feel like we should be playing this at Detroit Stadium, baseball stadium.
With Ted Nugent.
With Teddy Nugent shooting up some minks. In fact, that's what we could have. We could have like Mick and the Fat Man live in the Dallas Cowboys, whatever they are. Is the Dallas Cowboys? Yeah. Stadium. Ted Nugent. He's got a stand over there where you get to shoot minks. Other people. I don't know. We could have guess the age of the ancient rock star. That sort of thing.
Ooh, that'd be a challenge for people. Wouldn't it? No one would ever get it right. No, he's not that old. No, and still walking around.
Keith Richard. Is he alive? He must be 150. You don't know, do you? You don't know.
You just don't know, yeah.
I love the meme that you see of him standing and Adam and Eve are right next to him. There's
a picture That's of him right, yeah.
And they say, and Adam says to God, "Who's he?" And God says, "I don't know. It was he when I got here."
Absolutely, absolutely.
Anyway, Mick, let's delve into the beautiful pink Globite travel bag with its luxurious interior. And what have you got in there today? Let's get that open, mate. All right, what do you got in there today, mate?
There's a whole bunch of magazines.
Oh. What are you doing?
Well, and on the top has got, these are all the magazines that had crappy reviews of brilliant albums. And I thought, that's fair enough. So this episode is called Brilliant Albums Badly Reviewed. And we're going to talk about when critics and reviewers got it wrong.
Okay, well, we look forward to it. But first, before we continue...
Of course.
Let's just have a little look at what I have to offer. Well, it's time to wander once again through the crazy world of those rock gods as we talk legends, lies and lunacy. New segment, Mick. Legends, Lies and Lunacy.
I'm still umpa-paring there.
It's good, isn't it? So I thought I'd just, every now and again, not all the time, every now and again, I'll just pop into the annals of rock history and just pull out some strange things that some of the rock gods have done over the time.
Where are you going to find any content for that segment? I think it's going to be very hard for you.
It's going to be very hard. I've just got a little taster this time, mate, just a little taster.
Okay.
And we're going to kick off with a fellow by the name of Billy Idol. Do you remember Billy Idol?
Yeah.
Billy Idol, apparently, man of the White Wedding, spent 3 weeks hosting raucous parties in his Oriental Hotel penthouse in Thailand in 1989. The Rebel Yell rocker was charged $149,000 by the Thai establishment for room fees and damages. Idle ignored management and refused to vacate the room. Had to be forcibly removed by the military and carried out on a stretcher after being shot with a tranquilizer dart.
Well, Thailand, for all of its reputation, that doesn't surprise me. It's not a country where you go stuffing around with their laws.
To actually have the military coming to go, shoot him in the ass with a tranquilizer. It's like something out of a cartoon, isn't it?
It's beautiful, isn't it? Yeah.
Now, one of the lesser known wild men of rock and roll, very, very restrained normally, Keith Moon. I still remember Keith Moon meeting Norman Gunston, Norman Gunston was standing outside. He was standing outside the venue where Moon was pulling up in his Rolls Royce. Moon gets out of the car, pissed as a fart, holding a bottle of vodka, and pours it over top of Norman Gunston's head, and says, "You stupid fucking Aussie poofter," and walked off. And Norman Gunston said, "Oh, thanks very much, Mr. Moon." Anyway, the destructive antics of Keith Moon reportedly got the Who banned from every single Holiday Inn in the world. On his 21st birthday in 1967, Moon was said to have driven a Rolls-Royce into the swimming pool of a Michigan Holiday Inn. A Rolls-Royce. They don't float, you know.
I've seen photos of that.
It does exist.
It's just bloody cars in the pool with just the roof line out.
Yeah. They don't float. Never mind. Now, another one. This is what I was a little bit unexpected by. I didn't expect. James Brown has done some strange things in his time. But in 1988, James Brown stormed into an insurance company next to his office in Augusta, Georgia, somewhere, and pulled a shotgun out on employees for allegedly using his toilet. Brown reportedly had been high on PCP when the incident happened. He then led police in a car chase from the scene, as you would, before being arrested and serving 3 years in a South Carolina State Park Correctional Centre.
That makes it a very expensive poo, doesn't it?
Who's been using my toilet? I shall threaten them with a shotgun.
Oh. Yeah, that'd be right.
Anyway, if you do have any stories of interest, ladies and gentlemen, that you want to see on here, let me know. Drop me a line, and we'll every now and again we'll pull out a few stories from the from rock history, the annals of rock history, just for a bit of fun.
The lengths we'll go to try and get you to communicate with us.
That's right. Anyway, Mick, we shall move on, sir. We've got the topic there, so why don't you pull out the first magazine and give us some idea of what you're doing today, exactly.
Okay. Is the case – oh, you've already opened the case, haven't you? Yeah.
Case is sitting there. Sitting there, it's happily. Open. I can see it now. It's full of magazines. I don't even know how you got it up on the table. It's full of magazines. A lot of Rolling Stone in there from the history books, from the annals of history.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're a star performer.
They are well renowned for they were sort of clickbait before it became clickbait, weren't what?
They were clickbait at the newsstand.
That's it. But anyway, so tell us how you how we're going to work our way through this, buddy.
Okay, right. Look, you and I, over a beer, we've often laughed about how reviewers get things wrong. Today, I think we can look at some reviews that were so bad and so wrong that they should have lost, the reviewer should have lost his record reviewer's license. Mm. Yeah, just hopeless. So why does this happen? Well, not everyone has the same taste. You and I have even disagreed on certain albums. I know, and I won't bother floating which ones that might be, but it's certainly The Cure's The Cure's first album was never one of your favourites.
No.
Although it was one of mine.
Yeah. Yeah. Say no more.
Yeah. See, I'm working on it. I'm working on you. Reviewers don't understand an album. And, yeah, how could they? They're only human. They don't necessarily have any qualifications to understand the artistic reaches of certain musicians anyway. Maybe they've taken different drugs. They bring their personal biases into a review.
Yep.
And certainly I've read reviews and read stories where the reviewer has a personal beef with the artist and has let that carry across to a review, or has made the review part of their conflict.
Yep.
Maybe they heard the recording on a bad day. Maybe they'd run out of cocaine that day or something. Many reviewers, look, and you can see it every day, believe that they're there to criticise in only one form of the word, and not in a more general exposition sort of meaning of the word. Not to lead, enlighten, or introduce.
Rather just to fucking slam it, because they think they're being smart sometimes, I'm sure. I know more about juxtaposition than you do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And probably can't even spell it. That's why they have spell check. Sub editors who spell checked everything before they had Google. Look, there's some really good examples, and we'll talk about a few this afternoon. It's just horrendous. But as you say, Rolling Stone's a prime offender, and they keep coming up.
They do.
Led Zeppelin's first album, slammed as derivative, boring, no good. Black Sabbath's first record, same thing. Yeah, dude, these are two huge bands who've earned so much money, yeah, and been able to spend it on whatever they wanted.
So what songs are on the first Led Zeppelin album?
On the first Led Zeppelin album, mate, things like Communication Breakdown.
No, Shabby.
Yeah, it's a pretty ordinary song. I know, Dazed and Confused.
Oh, very shabby.
Yeah. Good Times, Bad Times.
Yeah. Terrible.
And some of the things, yeah. This is really personal stuff. Jimmy Page used to be in the Yardbirds.
Yes.
Yeah, now you might have heard of them.
Yeah, I did.
Bit of a rock band in the 60s in the UK. And Jimmy Page, he was just a session musician who would lucked a gig with the Yardbirds. Thought he could do better with his own band. And, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. But the British press never forgave him.
Oh, is that right?
For doing that, yeah. So that's why this ongoing enmity up until the end of the British Fleet Street Press and Jimmy Page.
Really?
Yeah, because they basically hated him and didn't forgive him for leaving Yardbirds and forming Led Zeppelin. So the critics criticised him for leaving the Yardbirds, and when they released their first album, Zeppelin, it was a feeding frenzy. It was like blood in the water with a bunch of sharks.
Yeah, right.
They just slammed it. And first offender, first one off the mark, Rolling Stone, John Mendelsohn, called Jimmy Page, believe it or not, a proficient blues artist. Yeah, that's like saying a Lamborghini is a car that on occasion can go fast. Yeah. Jimmy Page, by the way, writes weak, unimaginative songs. And he called Led Zeppelin a lesser version of the Jeff Beck group. Yeah, I bet he loves those words. He dubbed Robert Plant as, and here comes the obligatory Rod Stewart reference.
I don't think we had one last show, did we?
No, we missed it. We missed it. Oh, dear. Sorry, folks. He dubbed Robert Plant as nowhere near as exciting as Rod Stewart. It's good.
Gee. And he put that in print, did he?
Yeah. He'd live to regret that. In other publications, it was common to describe Page's guitar playing as pedestrian and Plant's poor singing voice.
My godfather.
So you wonder why Led Zeppelin released Led Zeppelin 4 with no label, no name, and no official launch. There was no official launch for 4. They just put it out in the shop.
Is that right?
Yeah. As a basic screw you to the music press, British music press.
And
obviously Rolling Stone by implication.
It's interesting. I mean, how do you come back from that? You know,
to write such a stupid review.
Just stupid.
Yeah. Just those three songs alone. Most bands, if they'd just done those three songs and split, would be so proud of themselves for the rest of their life. They do reunion tours every 3 years.
And Dazed and Confused was one of their great live songs, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Great
awesome.
Song.
Yeah. I've been dazed and I won't try that. Look, but it wasn't just little mediocre bands like Led Zeppelin that got slammed. The Beatles copped it.
The Beatles. Yeah. You'd have to be pretty game.
You'd have to be, wouldn't you?
To get stuck into the Beatles at anything.
And that's the problem with a lot of these reviewers. They saw themselves as legends in their own lunchtime.
Yeah, right.
Because they had the power over these musicians to slam their records and thereby hopefully influence record sales. Now, what we're going to find with the ones we talk about today, in the main, is that the public said, you're an idiot, and went and bought it anyway.
Yeah, so we may not like the album, but it's the public like the album. That's the most important thing.
They're the ones who come up with the money.
That's it.
Yeah, exactly. Abbey Road got slammed on release. Yeah, and Abbey Road, just the cover picture, is one of the most iconic album covers in the history of the world, history of album covers.
That's right, because we talked about... How many T-shirts are there out there with different versions of Abbey Road?
Absolutely, it's crazy. And the album itself, it's different, and it really echoes some of McCartney's love of music hall. Yeah, and so what? Yeah. Mm. If you're that big, you can do what you bloody like. Nick Cohn in the New York Times, who also later wrote for Rolling Stone.
Oh, right.
Of course, he wrote, "The tracks are nothing special." He went on to say that the great drawback is the words. On Abbey Road, you get only marshmallow. The words are limp-wristed, pompous and fake, and the album is an unmitigated disaster.
Unmitigated disaster?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's really putting your mouth where your mealy mouth is, yeah. Rolling Stone complained that the use of synthesizers, of all things, disembodied and artificialized the music. Another guy... blasted Abbey Road for treading a tenuous line between boredom, Beatledom and bubblegum. On you, fellas.
That is sensational.
The London Times said that even the album's best songs are only minor pleasures. And Life magazine said it's not one of the Beatles' greatest albums.
I know you've got a note of something there, which is now regarded as probably one of the Beatles' best love songs.
And, it's a lovely song, yeah.
And written by George Harrison and one of his best songs written in the Beatles, without doubt.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cocker released it originally, Joe Cocker, and we talked about that in the Joe Cocker episode. Frank Sinatra, he called it the best love song in the last 50 to 100 years. Yeah, and he was a bit cantankerous himself, but certainly when he had an opinion, he wasn't backward in putting it forward, and he was right.
I mean, I know that when Abbey Road was being recorded, there was a lot of a fair bit of discontent within the band, and they weren't really working that well as a band, and so you do get a bit of a what you could regard as a bit of a discoordinated sort of an album, but that didn't really change people's attitude to buying it.
Unmitigated disaster.
Unmitigated disaster. I just checked before, and one of the songs on the album has had over 1 billion downloads on Spotify.
1 billion. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah.
1 billion downloads.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing I just saw a review just recently from 2016 by some complete and utter dork who said, "I know the baby boomers are in complete denial about this, but the Beatles peaked as an album artist with Sgt. Pepper. After that, they put out a few great songs, but the album work was inconsistent at best."
Good on you, mate. Unmitigated disaster. I don't think I've ever read. Yeah, and that just follows into it. Some of these journos want to keep going. Yeah, they're doubling down on their own idiocy
and saying, "I'm still right." The fact that you sold billions of albums around the world. The fact that everybody loves it.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're doing because I'm much smarter than them.
Exactly right. Yeah, yeah.
What a fuckwit.
The world's biggest selling album in 1969. The world.
Unmitigated disaster.
Yeah, it's terrible. Every band in the world wish they could have an unmitigated disaster like that.
And now they're jumping on sort of the culture wars and say, well, it's only the fucking baby boomers that like it, you know.
We own everything else. We might as well own that album as well. What about Black Sabbath?
Yeah, what about Black Sabbath?
They released their first album around the same time.
It's interesting, isn't it? Yes, you wouldn't think so, would you?
No, they're so wildly different. Mm. But I'm sure that McCartney secretly wished he could have sung alongside Ozzy.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, he would have. Back in the 70s, because there was no heavy metal.
No.
Black Sabbath was heavy metal, the first heavy metal band. Led Zepp paved the way, but Black Sabbath, bloody heavy. Led Zeppelin was hard rock.
Yeah, they took it the step further.
They did.
Father of metal.
Yeah, absolutely. Black Sabbath has a sound of their own. They invented a complete sound of their own, especially their early stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not a Sabbath fan, but everything up until Paranoid or a bit later is just great. Yeah, you listen to it. That's before Ozzy became a walking caricature.
Mm.
in other words, before they had so many drugs that they were on another planet.
Yeah, he's got a bad back now, so, you know.
That's right. He's got a bad everything.
Spoke about it last year. He's coming good, though.
Oh, yeah, right. Even my special needs son has got Paranoid and Iron Man on his phone.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He knows those songs really well.
Paranoid is a great album.
It is. It's a fabulous album. It could arguably be their best.
Mm.
But, you know, we're not here to say that. We're not here to be critics ourselves. Well, maybe a little bit. But at least we're right when we do it. This album could be said to have given birth to heavy metal. But if they had their way, Rolling Stone would have killed them at birth.
Lester Bangs.
Yeah, that's his name. Yeah, now, that's a cool name, but another one of these people is a legend in his own lunchtime. I've read a lot of his stuff and I'm not all that impressed. He called the band unskilled labourers and a cream ripoff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, good. Tony Iommi's guitar playing dribbles wooden Claptonisms.
Fuck.
Yeah, it's unreal. And stiff recitations of Cream cliches that sound like he learned them out of a book. Yeah. Being a critic means that you have to needlessly insult people wrongly, apparently.
What a knob.
And not bad for Tony Iommi, who, of all magazines, Rolling Stone, dubbed as number 13 in the world's best guitarists. And relegated Clapton to 35. It's good stuff.
Ah, they're consistent.
Yeah.
Consistently stupid.
Consistently hopeless, absolutely. Robert Christgau, who we've mentioned before and we'll mention again today, in the Village Voice, so the New York Culture magazine, he gave the album by Black Sabbath a C-.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he used to grade everything, you know, like a school teacher.
Yes, right.
And, you know, A through D. He called the album bullshit and a reflection of the worst of the counterculture. Well, boy, oh, the counterculture ate you. And it ain't you.
It's insane.
So influential is this album. Yeah, it's like an unmitigated disaster again. I remember a series of interviews with early 90s bands from Northern America. You know, Mudhoney, Dinosaur Jr., all quite successful in their own right, talking about their formative influences. Seattle bands couldn't believe when they heard Black Sabbath about how thick and sludgy it sound, heavy metal. Yeah, like they were playing through a I saw one quote says, oh, it sounded like they were playing through a barbiturate haze. Oh, they probably
they
were.
Probably were. Yeah. great stuff.
Yeah. And look, while we're on the line of picking on hugely successful bands, you know the band that did Dark Side of the Moon? You ever heard of them?
Pink Floyd, was it?
That was the one, yes. They did an album after Dark Side of the Moon called Wish You Were Here, which personally is my favourite Pink Floyd album. Well, that and The Wall.
Also one of my favourites.
Yes, yeah.
One of my favourites. I love how it builds. The first side just builds and builds and builds.
Yeah.
And comes out with some of the great songs. Anyway.
It's a shame. It was unconvincing and ponderous. Critical lack of imagination in all departments. Yeah. Rolling Stone, surprisingly, said lackadaisical, devoid of passion. It's good, isn't it? Yeah, it's great stuff. Maybe they actually heard the barbed shots at themselves. There's a line in the song, Have a Cigar.
Yes.
You come in here, dear boy, have a cigar. You're going to go far. Oh, the band is quite fantastic. That is really what I think. Oh, by the way, which one's pink?
That's a great line.
Yeah.
That's a great line.
All you critics who know everything about everything, you don't know anything.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
They really slammed them off. I remember the first time I heard and bought this album. Mm. I heard it on the radio.
Yep.
Jumped on my motorbike up to the shopping mall, and brought it back inside my jacket, hoping it didn't blow out.
So in 1975.
Yep.
You would still be which shopping center?
Which one?
I always like to know what shopping center you went to.
Roselands.
We love you.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent, yes. So you would have gone to Edels. Edels, was it Edels?
I forget, it wasn't.
It was Edels or something like that.
Yeah, they don't exist anymore.
E-D-E-L-S.
Yeah, I know the one. Yeah, it could have been. I can't remember the name. Yeah, very few record shops I can remember the name of.
Yeah,
but I can remember where they were and what they looked and what they had up on the wall.
Yeah, okay. But I think I think that's what it would have been back in those days.
What about Akka Dakka? At one stage, the world's biggest concert-grossing band, AC/DC, for those who've never heard Akka Dakka. High Voltage, around the same time, 1976.
Mm.
They were big in Australia.
Yeah.
And just at the time they were ready to break overseas, their label released their first two albums called TNT, surprisingly, and High Voltage.
Yeah.
Both fairly ordinary songs that we've never heard before.
Nah, all very obscure.
And, look, I can remember seeing them at Daceyville Police Boys Club.
Where's Daceyville?
I
don't even know where that is.
Eastern suburbs, just as you head out of the city.
Really?
Yeah, along Anzac Parade.
Okay.
I didn't know anything about them, but someone said, okay, let's go in here and see what's going on. And Akka Dakka was playing. So that was back really early when they were playing in smaller venues and you were actually able to feel the music, see the band playing on stage. I was just blown away. I knew nothing about them. Went with some friends. What a sound.
Yeah,
what a fantastic band.
Brilliant band to see live.
And, of course, Bon was the singer then.
Yeah.
And he was great. The simplicity of the songs, they could reproduce them live without losing the essence of the song. But once again, Rolling Stone didn't think they were much good. Never seen them live. The reviewer declared, this is one of the best I've ever read.
Okay.
The release of the first US album by these Australian gross-out champions shows that hard rock has unquestionably hit its all-time low.
Oh, this
it's
is
good,
sensational.
Isn't it? Bon Scott's vocals were truly annoying. And the band was two guitars, bass and drums with mindless three-chord formations.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah. Talk about not reading the room.
Billy Altman.
Yep. Yeah.
He's wonder where he is nowadays.
Yeah, probably not much of a reviewer.
No. I wonder if you were in the reviewer club, you go down to the reviewers club after work and everybody, do they all point at each other and say, you wrote that review, or do they sit there and go, I remember when I pointed out that Akka Dakka was no good. They did all right, but thanks to me, really, because after that they lifted their game.
I love it. It's beautiful. Yeah. And bloody McCartney had to lift his game too.
Oh, hold on. Billy Altman is an award-winning cultural journalist.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Oh,
what awards would he win? The award for some of the worst reviews ever.
Biggest fuckwit.
Being unable to read the room.
Being a fuckwit.
Yeah, I think so. That's it. Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Good on you, Bill.
Thanks for that, mate.
When McCartney left the Beatles, he waited a little while and then started to release a series of solo albums.
Mm.
You're the McCartney fan. I'm not necessarily a big McCartney fan, except for things like Maybe I'm Amazed, which was an awesome album. But he released Ram, his second album. His first album got a bit slammed. And by all accounts, it was probably a bit low key for what they were all expecting.
It was nicely packaged, though. It was a nice fold-out album.
Oh, right.
Nice pictures inside and stuff.
That's
like
important.
That. Yeah. It is important sometimes.
Yeah.
Some of his early stuff was a little bit jerky sort of thing. Like he had sort of some really, really inspired songs and then some songs that were I don't know, a little bit. You know how he gets a bit whimsy sort of at times,
He does, yeah.
But he sells millions.
But it's all his. In the Beatles, you got five songs on an album. Lennon got a few. That's got right. The other five, and Harrison was lucky if he got one.
That's right. And they always had to have one for Ringo.
Yeah, of course, for the girls, yes.
But, yeah, this album was another one that's got some great songs on it and is massively popular.
Yeah.
Massively popular.
Rolling Stone led the charge.
What did they say?
Oh, this album is so incredibly inconsequential and so monumentally irrelevant and unbearably inept. He must have been very disappointed that someone had already said unmitigated disaster. he said McCartney had benefited immensely from collaboration with Lennon.
Here's the thing. Lennon and McCartney hadn't collaborated particularly for years.
Yes, absolutely. So
that's just all bullshit. They'd written separately, basically, for a very long time.
Yeah.
So, you know, to say that their collaborations were that McCartney benefited from Lennon is just bullshit. They were separate musos, really.
Yeah, absolutely. But McCartney was the one who left the Beatles and broke up the band. And that's what he was blamed for.
Really?
Later facts have suggested that wasn't probably the case.
Wasn't quite the case, but anyway.
But McCartney, he was absolutely vilified in the press, and that carried through to his record reviews.
Mm.
The public, on the other hand, said, "You're all fools," and went and bought it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Big time. Yeah, it was. Look, I won't even go on. The other reviews we've got, you know, Robert Christgau, NME, New Musical Express, called it mediocre. Get a grip.
An excursion into an almost unrelieved tedium.
Now, maybe he was listening to a different album. Maybe they released a different one to the one we were able to hear. Yeah, it's just quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Ah, ridiculous.
And then the Stones got hammered by the same thing. At the same time, these guys got blood in the water and thought, let's pick on some of these rock gods. They're getting too big for their boots. They don't recognise that we know everything about culture.
We know what the public likes.
Exactly right. We know what the public should
like. That's right. So we will tell them what they will like, and they'll listen to our reviews and follow our advice.
Absolutely. Huh. You heard of an album called Exile on Main Street by the Rolling Stones?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, which personally, it's my favourite Stones album.
Yeah.
I love it. Yeah, and that's not casting aspersions on the one before it, Sticky Fingers, which is also excellent.
Mm.
Yeah, it's bloody fantastic. But I love Exile on Main Street. And the reviewers who criticised it criticised things like, what they criticised, they yawned collectively. They said it was inconsistent in quality and style. It misses the mark. Generally slaughtered it. Whereas what I love about it is exactly what they talked about it. It is inconsistent. It's rough. And it sounds like a band getting together and getting rid of all of the studio bits and say, hey, let's play some rock and roll.
So I'm just going back to Australian Chartbook.
Oh, right.
By David Kent. So Sticky Fingers, which was lauded as the Top of the Pops fantastic album, did get to number one in Australia.
Yep, good on.
And was in the charts for 19 weeks. Exile on Main Street got to number two on the Australian charts and was in the charts for 20 weeks.
Big deal of difference there. Not.
Misread the room, methinks.
Yeah,
misread the room.
Yeah, I love Sticky Fingers. It's different the way it starts and tracks on it. Yeah, it's got Rolling Stones gold stuff. Happy, with Keith singing.
Yeah,
had to wake him up to sing. But that's another story. Sweet Virginia,
having a bit of a snooze.
Yeah. Tumbling Dice.
Yep.
Could you get a more epitome of a Rolling Stones song than Tumbling Dice? Yeah, it just illustrates how important Mick Taylor was to the band.
Mm.
And how much he changed them and added to them. Keith was still very much the driving force, but he was pretty off his face
at this particular time.
Yeah, he was up to his ears from his toes on heroin.
I like the cover too. I like the cover of this album.
That's a lot of work. You too copied that style later on.
Oh, with Zoo. Achtung
Baby.
Achtung Baby.
Yeah. And you can't go wrong. It's a great style to copy.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's good.
Yeah.
Amazing. Oh, and Rolling Stone then went on to rank it as number 7 in its greatest albums.
They did. They can't stick with one story. Yeah. If you're going to tell me something's bad, then tell me why it's bad in an honest assessment and keep with that.
And they're just being controversial, just rhetoric.
That's exactly what it is. It's clickbait.
Yeah.
Or the print equivalent of clickbait.
Print bait. Yeah. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But it's still the same now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, absolutely.
What's your next piece of shit you've got, mate?
What about Low by David Bowie?
Oh, rubbish.
Yeah, absolute rubbish.
Absolute rubbish.
Yeah, yeah. It was straight after Station to Station, which was just awesome.
Oh, terrible. Another terrible album.
The musicianship left a lot to be desired. Look, this was the first of the Brian Eno albums, so he really dramatically changed his style, and I don't think the reviewers understood it.
Or didn't want to. They wanted Ziggy Stardust back.
That's exactly right, yeah. They're not very much on change. They're all OCD individuals. But I remember reading one review. Not all reviews were bad. This one was sensible, the bit I can remember. Described it as Bowie clearing the decks. Oh, okay. And he certainly bloody changed from what he'd done beforehand.
Yeah.
To progress to the next phase of his career, whatever that might be, that sounded fair enough to me. But look, if I'd known I would have needed it 50 years later, I would have remembered the bloody author's name.
Oh, okay.
But I can't remember that.
I did it 50 years later.
Yeah, yeah. Rolling Stone, those stars of media commentary. Of music commentary, Bowie lacks the self-assured humour to pull off his avant-garde aspirations. Any discipline in Bowie's writing and performance was due solely to the band.
What?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
No, of course not. Dave Marsh in Cream found a lack of thought in real songs, and this album was a new low point. Maybe he was just doing a pun on the title.
Yeah.
That'd be witty, wouldn't it? Yeah. It's not what you expect out
hilarious.
Of viewers. Yeah,
fucking idiot.
Record Mirror found the album boring at first listen, and that Bowie had hit an all-time low. Look, these puns with words, and you just can't buy this sort of stuff. This is great. The album lacks a genuine vision, which, when you go back and listen to it, you can exactly see how he's influenced his next 10 years.
Mm.
Yeah, with this album. Charles Shaw Murray, and anybody with a name, a double-barreled name like this, really, why would you listen to him? Extremely negative, a state of mind beyond desperation, and finished his review with, "Who needs this shit?"
You do, because that's how you make your money, by reviewing it.
Yeah, you're fool.
Fucking idiot.
Robert Christgau got into it. The LA Times got into it. The Guardian got into it. Sold reasonably well, and I don't know that it was intended to. You got the Kent charts there to see how well it did in Australia.
So really, album wise, Bowie never really he sort of got to 10, 8, that sort of thing on the Australian charts.
Yep.
Until Scary Monsters, which got to number one,
which is my selection as his best. Yeah.
Low got to 10. It was in the charts for 17 weeks.
Yep.
So, did fine.
Yeah. Bowie came into his own more when he'd finished making great music. He became more of that media type star, touring. People started to buy into Heroes as an ongoing album oriented radio song.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. Bowie was never as big as his legend would have it.
No, that's right. He did all right for himself, though.
He did all right for himself. I loved him. I idolized him. Yeah, yeah. He got by.
He got by.
Yeah. This album laid the groundwork for Heroes. And anyone who looks back at it now agrees, that he had to stop Ziggy and Aladdin Sane.
Yeah.
To do Heroes, and if he hadn't done Low, he couldn't have done Heroes. Certainly not as a success. But this album, what an influence! You couldn't have without this album. You wouldn't have had Joy Division. You wouldn't have had Magazine, Ultravox, Kraftwerk, all of them. Somebody been looking in my record cabinet? I got all of them.
You do. I do. Indeed.
And I've got the next one too. Harvest.
Oh, that's shocking, that album.
Isn't this crazy? This is just crazy. They're picking, you know, the stuff that people just idolize as some of the most wonderful music ever created in the history of the world and trying to tell you that it's crap. Personally, yeah, you know, I saw Harvest on the list of the worst reviewed albums ever, and I thought, you've got to be kidding me.
I can't believe
it. You really got to be kidding me. Personally, my favourite Neil Young album is Rush Never Sleeps, and I like After the Gold Rush as well.
Sure.
But yeah, to say that Harvest is derivative and boring, it's just
This is a classic album.
It is.
The album cover is classic. The songs on it are classic.
Absolutely.
And it's just got, I mean, it's just an amazing album. Yeah. Anyway, that's okay. Give me some of the highlights from our intellectual friends.
The Montreal Gazette. You know, it's his countrymen there, Canadians. Talked about the album's embarrassing moments.
Like?
Oh, that's one of the kinder critiques. Rolling Stone, surprisingly, called it a rip-off of After the Gold Rush.
What?
It's Neil Young. That's what he does. He does Neil Young. A discomfortably unmistakable...
He ripped himself off.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, yeah. A discomfortingly unmistakable resemblance of nearly every song on this album to an earlier Neil Young composition. They called the needle and the damage done, you know, really heavy duty song. They called it glib.
Do you want to know the only album to made it number one from Neil Young in Australian charts?
Let me guess, something else.
Harvest.
Yeah, it's just a joke.
Anyway, the people voted.
Extraordinary! Yeah,
what a bunch of turkeys.
Harvest was the best-selling album around the world in 1972. It was on the Billboard 200 in the US.
John Mendelsohn's got some good stuff up his sleeve, hasn't he?
Hasn't he? He really works hard.
He works real hard.
Yeah.
Danny Whitten, we've come across him before too somewhere. I don't remember where.
Danny Whitten was one of Neil Young's friends and roadies. So he was with the band right from the start.
That's right.
He OD'd.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's right. Danny Whitten, yes.
And he OD'd later after this album. Yeah. And Young's actually written a couple of songs about Danny Whitten.
Yeah, that's right. I do remember. I'd forgotten him.
Yep. And, Rolling Stone, stars and masters of cultural assessment, then went on to rate this album that they'd slagged as the 78th best album of all time.
Yep.
Yeah. Good on you, fellas.
No, that's good. That's a job well done. Okay. Give me another bad album.
Yeah. Well, I think Blood on the Tracks.
Bob Dylan?
By Bob Dylan. Remember when we talked about this album? We talked about some of these bad reviews and couldn't understand them. Yeah, everything that they reviewed and said was bad was what we regarded as a great aspect of the album.
I love this album.
It would have to be one of my top 10 albums. Yeah.
I still listen to it all the time.
Yeah, yeah. The songwriting, the playing, loose, flowing, and yet that loose and flowing style. Rolling Stone, good on you, John Landau, called it made with typical shoddiness.
typical shoddiness.
Oh, God. But look, Rolling Stone stars wanted to have a bet both ways on this one. So they released this review called Made with Typical Shoddiness and It's Crap, with another album on the facing page that said it was magnificent.
Oh, really?
So they had a bet each way on
it. Nice work.
Yep. NME, New Musical Express's Nick Kent. It's not your Kent Music Report fellow, said the songs were so trashy they sound like mere practice takes. I don't know how they could have read that. From the minute I heard a track off this album, I thought, how bloody good is this?
So I found I just went to Big Bad Bob's 1001 Albums You Must Listen To Before You Die. Blood on the Tracks is oddly enough there. They don't say you should listen to it because it's shit, though. They say you should listen to it because it's good. So he says, the wordy whining, the wheezy harmonica, we won't lie to you, they're all there, but so are some of the brightest songs in a career not short of sparklers.
Yeah, excellent. That's exactly that. That's my assessment of this album too.
The music touches on blues, folk, proto-dire straightisms without dwelling on any style long enough for it to appeal to Paul. For its appeal to Paul.
Yes.
The diversity is due in part to Dylan. This is something I didn't know. Diversity is due in part to Dylan having revamped the album after a test pressing was issued in 1974, making it one of the great bootleggers. Unsatisfied with the recording he made, he recut Tangled Up in Blue and You're a Big Girl Now, Idiot Wind, Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts, and If You See Her, Say Hello, with different musos.
The bulk of the album.
There's not much left.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and those criticisms of, you know, shoddy and just not well played and so on and so on. What he was looking for.
I'll just finish the last line.
Is there more? Great.
If you listen to only one Dylan album, you want to be this.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It is just an absolutely inspiring album.
Brilliant album.
Even for people who don't like Dylan, and not everybody does. You know, some don't like him, but they can, you know, respect his history. Yeah. But this is just an absolutely spectacular album.
Brilliant album.
And in Rolling Stone, they cannot keep to a position. In 2003, they made it number 16 on the 500 greatest albums of all time.
Good to see their commitment.
Oh, yeah.
Stupidity.
And Big Bad Bob's got it there, yeah, and he thinks it's terrific. It's a wonderful album. And,
yeah, it's a great album.
Yeah, go back and have a look at, have a listen to what we say about it.
No, it's great.
I can't even remember what episode, so you'll have to listen to all 60 to find it.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was. We did talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. So that's enough.
All right, give me another one.
Never mind the bollocks, here's the Sex Pistols.
Oh, the seminal... one of the most influential
rock and roll albums ever. Look, this is a bit different, this one. The reviewers, because they were looking for the next best thing, the latest thing, actually jumped on board.
Oh, okay.
With this one. So most of the reviews said it was pretty good. I've got one that I'll come to in a moment where the reviewer didn't understand it at all. And surprisingly, guess what magazine it was in? Yep, you got it.
Rolling something or other.
They released the single Pretty Vacant before the album. And, I thought critics were supposed to listen to new music, at least partly in context of what's happening. England was in turmoil.
Yep.
The economy was shot to the pack. Music in general was in turmoil in England in the mid-70s. You had your big acts, your Pink Floyds and what have you, but there was a lot of confusion in English society, in English music. There was nothing there that would stand out and say, this is exactly what it is. And then along comes punk.
Mm.
And these guys waved the flag for punk. Punk had been going on. There'd been a lot of bands, you know, standing on stage and gobbing at the audience and playing very simple songs that people were loving. You know, people were attending shows, all of that sort of gear. And so the Pistols jumped on that. They were formed by Malcolm McLaren. Something decent that he did in his life, at least.
Yeah, apart from being just a complete nut arsehole for most of it.
That's right. But the review in Rolling Stone said, the music is overly simplistic and rudimentary. It's not very good. Yeah. Read the room, boyo. Why the hell did punk happen in the first place? Because the music was overly complicated and not very good.
It's the definition of punk music.
Yeah, yeah. They should have picked up this review. Yeah, and poor Mike Oldfield copped the brunt of it. He came out at the wrong time with an all-instrumental album, didn't he?
Complex.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And I'm sure he's still bitter about the fact that, as far as he was concerned, the Sex Pistols were part of his demise for quite a long number of years.
Yeah, and he'd be right. He'd be right.
Yep.
But look, despite that stupid review by, believe it or not, Rolling Stone, the media, particularly the English media, was on side with them because they'd read the room. They said, you know, you got all these really many of them were atrocious, the bands, and that was the point. Mm. Yeah, they were. And then along comes the Pistols. They could play well. Yeah, they had. They could. Mostly. Well, I mean, Sid Vicious couldn't. No, because you know, he was off his face on heroin all the time. But you listen to the others, and they were all
okay,
rudimentary, but playing great rock and roll music, and that's what it was. It's the same thing that they play today. You know, we found when we watched the concert of them online.
Yeah, that's right.
And you can reproduce it easily. Yeah, all you got to do is play three chords. That's happy right. days, and away we go.
Away we go.
Society didn't want them. The establishment, the BBC banned them. The charts, they never got onto the charts because they never got mentioned in the charts. They refused to play they refused to print the name of the album and the name of the band.
Yeah.
Probably because they were pretty rude and insulting to Queen Elizabeth, who was obviously the Queen. Yeah, she was all good. God Save the Queen was banned, citing gross bad taste. Nevertheless, it debuted at number one. I bought it. When it was released over there, it just happened to be over there, and that's one of the proudest moments of my life. 60 weeks in the top 25. Some critics still tried to take the opportunity to slag off the Pistols, but it was stupid.
Yeah, you missed.
They weren't getting anywhere. You know, they're on an album that, despite everything you've thrown at them, we're going to sell shitloads of this record.
It's a seminal record without doubt.
Yep. So, how we doing for time? We still got a couple more.
Oh, I'll do a couple more, I think, mate. A couple more. Give me a couple more.
What about Jacko? Michael Jackson.
Oh, wacko.
Yeah. He gets a Guernsey in a lot of our episodes. Maybe we should have the obligatory Michael Jackson reference. Yeah. Maybe we can alternate him with Rod Stewart.
Rod Stewart. And what was his monkey called? Is it Coco or something like that? I can't remember his monkey.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to find out, and we're going to mention the monkey as much as we possibly can.
Maybe we should, yeah.
Because I think the monkey used to put his hand down his pants and throw shit around the place. Because he used to wear a
that's
nappy.
That's what monkeys do.
He had a nappy on.
Yeah. Well, that's because he used to throw shit around the place. This album was generally reviewed favourably.
Right.
But damned with faint praise a lot of the time. I mean, what you're dealing with is an artist who sold more records than anybody else. This album sold more records than anything except Thriller. This was a huge, huge hit.
That's all right.
Yeah. But the LA Times only gave it 3 out of 4 stars, labelled the album disappointing because the sales weren't as high as Thriller. For God's sake.
Jesus Christ.
It's unbelievable.
Doing it tough, eh? Doing it real tough.
Yeah.
Interesting because, you bring out a magnificent album and so the next one's maybe not quite as good, or maybe it is, you know, minor detail. But say, oh, well, he's fucked that up, hasn't he? Eh? I mean, he's
lost it.
Oh, jeez. See, the next album's not as good.
Yeah. And Rolling Stone, we're up to their usual standard. Cool. The album is not bad, but disappointing. Get a grip. This album, 5 consecutive number ones. Bad, The Way You Make Me Feel, The Man in the Mirror, you know, stuff like that. There's, people would give their left arm to be able to reproduce, to have a song of the caliber of any of these songs. Now, whether you're white, black, or whatever music you like, Michael Jackson was in his own category.
That's it. So just back to the chart book in Australia.
Yeah.
Thriller got to number one. Yeah. Was in there for 114 weeks. But Bad got to number 2.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So clearly the public voted with their feet on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, I've got to be... I'm going to grow up to be a reviewer when I get big, when I get real big.
When I get real big.
Yeah. See if anyone picks that reference. What about Kate Bush, your favourite?
Oh, I love Kate. Love Kate.
She got slammed for Wuthering Heights. It really is just so comical, the way that these people carry on, as if they have a right to know anything at all. The Guardian said, and The Guardian writes a lot of good stuff. I really can't understand
it. True.
She has an odd combo of artiness and artlessness, a middle brow soft option.
I don't even know what that means.
Nothing.
I don't. That doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
You want to be arty, so listen to this because you don't have to put too much effort in.
And artlessness. Yeah, yeah, it doesn't. That's just nonsense.
She has all the unpleasant aspects of David Bowie in his early career.
What?
Who are you talking to? They're talking to English. This is the New Musical Express, an English paper. Yeah, David Bowie walked on water at that stage of the game in England.
Well, I don't understand. It doesn't make any sense.
Now, I remember one time we were talking about Wuthering Heights because you're even today a big Kate fan and you've loved her later albums. Yep. I wasn't quite so excited, but that doesn't matter. And you told me about Wuthering Heights Day.
That's right. Right across the world. This happens right across the world. People dress up as Kate Bush in the red dress and dance the song in parks around the world. She's not very popular.
No. People hate her.
And you remember she did a concert. She did I think she did about 5 concerts a few years ago now, and they sold out in about 3 minutes or something like that.
Wow.
It's been a bit more than a couple of years ago. It was about 5 or 6 years ago, I think. And if you listen to the album, the only thing I can say also. One of the things is that some of the songs she's written on that album is when she was 13.
Is that right? Wow. Just unbelievable.
An unbelievable talent. And she also holds the world's Guinness Book of Records thing for being the first female artist in pop history to have written every track on a million-selling album. It's not a good album, is it?
No, it's crap. Every track on the album is Kate Bush, and it's just so different. A really unique, wonderful sound. I really can't understand how these critics who see themselves as so far above us in understanding and helping us to understand what's happening in culture wouldn't know if their ass was on fire.
And interesting, the record label didn't want Wuthering Heights to be the single. They wanted the man with the child in his eyes to be the number one single.
Lovely song, but Wuthering Heights. Wuthering Heights has never been anything like it before or since.
Don't do that. Don't do that. Anyway, she is another one who actually ended up taking control of her own label and all that, produced her own label and took control of her music. And excellent. A lot of her family are actually in Make It All Work. Okay, you got one more.
Got one more? How about another album, a bit like Kate Bush, The Velvet Underground and Nico.
Almost identical, almost indistinguishable. Yeah.
I can imagine Lou Reed doing Wuthering Heights. Perhaps not.
Perhaps not. It would be funny to watch, though.
The critics hated it, and that probably made Lou Reed very happy indeed.
Yeah. Yes, he's not one to.
He was never looking to please anybody.
No. That's right.
Despite the beauty in some of his songs, look, as we've said before, and look, I might be frothy a bit about this album because it is absolutely an awesome album. I'll Be Your Mirror is as gentle a love song as has ever been written, and it's by bloody snotty Lou Reed. Yeah, I find it hard to believe you don't know the beauty you are, but if you don't, let me be your eyes. Critics called the album completely unprofessional. It's probably because some of it was. It was fairly ordinary production. They didn't have any money. You know, yeah. And Andy Warhol, Andy Warhol espoused the band and was supposedly their manager and all of that sort of thing. But at that time, Andy Warhol's money for his artworks only came after he died.
Yeah, that's right.
He was struggling for a buck every day of the week.
That's right.
In New York. So to have him producing the album is a bit of a joke. So they were on their bums.
It was more of a vehicle for him to get a little bit more famous, wasn't it?
Exactly right. That's all he saw anything as.
Yeah.
So, the production was poor, and we've talked about how Mo Tucker's drums cut out because the mic broke.
That's right. I love that. Yeah. And you can hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
You can hear it after the drums disappear.
Yeah, it's so many. I won't even bother giving a name to everybody. Confusing sounds, most depressing, and whatever the message, I failed to get it. As lifeless and inanimate as the discarded banana peel, touching every cliche in the rock and roll spectrum. Cliches, bloody Lou Reed wrote them. One big savage sound. and tedious despite their ventures into electric viola. So this guy's good. He liked Cale, but he didn't like anything else of the album.
Yeah.
Cale, we're talking about John Cale, who played viola in this band.
It's love just, a viola player.
Everyone loves the viola. You can't go wrong with it. This album's been reappraised.
And oh, really? Who
Everybody. Oh, and they recognise that it's one of the most important albums ever made.
Oh, really?
But nobody said that at the time. Unprofessional. Badly recorded. Absolutely astounding about where this album, yeah. Because they didn't understand it. They didn't get it. They didn't see the point. If you're singing about ugly stuff, and Lou Reed was singing about New York, which was a scuzzy city on the verge of bankruptcy at the time they released this, and they didn't understand it. So they did all that they can do, and that's slander it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, once again, you're sort of saying, read the room, you know, read the room. What are you looking at here? What are you hearing here?
Yeah.
And they're not picking up what it is.
Yeah. How could you not like some of the songs on that album? I can understand them freaking out a little bit about heroin.
Sure.
But you know, any sort of appraisal of that song would see that you might not like the content and you know, you don't have to take it or like it or approve of it, but the song itself is just absolutely astounding. You know, the way it slows down and speeds up, which is not just amateur drumming. It's deliberate.
No, that's exactly right. But the other thing I think that is groundbreaking when you think about it, this album came out in 1967.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
It's an unbelievable album for 1967. That is like, you know, once again, I keep using the word seminal because it's the only one I can think of, but it is a seminal album. And I remember hearing David Bowie talking about it. He was saying how, you know, everybody was talking about listening to the Beatles, but he said, really? People will listen to I'm Waiting for the Man.
Yeah, yeah.
And that guitar and those drums, that's what the young guitarists were playing.
Even before he made it, he released Hunky Dory, which was one of the albums on his climb, and it has a song with thanks to VU, some VU white light reflected.
Oh, is that right?
In the credits.
Ah, yeah. There you go.
So he went to New York and met Reed and hung out with them and saw them play quite some time before he became anything at all.
Wow. Yeah. There you go.
So there you go.
Oh, well, another one bites the dust. All right, well, I think we might call it quits. We may do some more of these later on in the year, I think. What do you think?
Look, mate, I think so. Look, we've barely scratched the surface of stuff. You can see the stack of paper I've got here. It's, you know, it's as thick as an issue of Rolling Stone when they were produced in paper. Other bands, successful bands today, yeah, I'll just mention a couple, but the victims of shoddy reviewers. Pearl Jam, ever heard of them?
No.
Queen, Guns N' Roses, Leonard Cohen, Oasis, Bob Dylan again, Simon and Bridge Over Troubled Waters were slammed by reviewers at the time.
We need to actually go through and just pull out some of those reviewers' names and start giving them a pass mark on some of their reviews.
Exactly right, yeah. Yeah, not to mention the huge list of albums. It's another episode again that weren't successful on release. Yeah. Public didn't even get them, but they became iconic over time. Look, I have my little spray here. I know we're like critics ourselves. So, but I think that we're right. Yeah, and so some of these people are trained as journalists, and I will give some of these people that we're slamming credit. I don't know what they're saying, but gee, they write well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, the fact that these critics often change their mind later really sets up the question: why do they think they have the right to influence the opinion of millions?
Yeah,
I've read books and articles by many of these so-called top critics, and find that often they're crap. Pretentious pieces of ego masquerading as learned comment.
Well, Mick, that's been another great little episode, and I thank you very much for all that work. What have you got for us next time?
Mate, I think that one of the people we've given a Guernsey to in the last couple of episodes, Bob Mould and Husker Du.
All right, that's going to be coming your way quick.
In 2 weeks.
All right, thanks very much. See you next time. Well, that's a wrap, and thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe. It's free. And if you like this, tell your friends about us. Also, contact us at mickandthefatman@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks very much. See you next time.